Support for this public radio podcast is provided by Cleveland Clinic, expanding globally and committed every day to providing innovative treatments and hope to patients worldwide. Online at clevelandclinic.org. And by Constellation Energy, a global provider of fuels, power, and energy services, committed to environmentally sound, energy-efficient, and sustainable energy solutions. Constellation Energy, the way energy works.
I'd like a venti tip jar, please.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Starbucks baristas in California have won a class action lawsuit against the company. Last night, a San Diego judge ordered Starbucks to pay $100 million in back tips to lower-level employees. Dan Gretsch explains.
Starbucks' policy has been to share tips equally between baristas and their supervisors. Tips were pooled, then distributed at week's end according to hours worked. But California law forbids supervisors from sharing in employee tips. The case isn't clear-cut. Shift supervisors take orders and make frappuccinos, too.
We're not talking about good or evil here. They all poured coffee.
That's the appropriately named John Coffey. He's an expert in class action lawsuits at Columbia University. He says it may make sense that tips were shared, but that may have still broken the law.
It's a regulatory line drawn by the state of California that you can't share this. It's not necessarily fraud on the customer or fraud on the worker in a more classic moralistic sense.
Up to 100,000 California baristas could be affected by the ruling, meaning payouts in the thousands. Now that's a fat tip. Starbucks plans an appeal. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
After a wild week, Wall Street takes a breather today. Despite Bear Stearns, despite rumors and anxiety and bad profit reports, stocks actually gained about 3% for the week. Gold and oil prices both lost 10%. The dollar bounced back after a string of losses. Not much action overseas today either. The Asian markets did close 2% higher. President Bush and some people in Congress have been trying to limit the amount of pork in the budget. But something happened this week that wasn't very encouraging. John Dimsdale reports from Washington.
This year, the House Appropriations Committee decided to try a new system to help it process the tens of thousands of member requests for special budget line items known as earmarks. Instead of putting them on paper, the committee told lawmakers to upload their requests to a website by March 19th. On that day, the website collapsed from so much traffic. Keith Ashdown at the watchdog Taxpayers for Common Sense says the sheer number of requests shows no one is keeping track.
If their new website can't deal with an amount of earmark requests coming in, it's clear that they're not going to be able to manage this when they actually have to vet and prioritize these projects.
Last week, lawmakers overwhelmingly rejected a bill to limit earmarks. The website is back online, and the committee has extended the deadline for earmark requests until midnight Monday. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The New York Auto Show begins today. For the Detroit companies, there's plenty to be worried about right now. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio.
GM's playing with its balance sheet, and Ford's cutting costs again, and Chrysler's lowering production. David Sedgwick with Automotive News says that's really all U.S. automakers can do to weather an economic train wreck. Cutting production will mean smaller profits, but that's better than unsold inventory piling up on dealer lots. Sedgwick's concerned about the future of Chrysler and Ford.
They both have a cash cushion, although we think Chrysler's cash cushion is pretty thin. And if I had to worry about any one automaker in the short term, it would be Chrysler.
Especially if a recession sparks a price war. Sedgwick says that would be hard on Chrysler, but GM's not up to speed either. As gas gets more expensive, consumers want smaller cars, not exactly a big three specialty. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
In Chicago, nothing's more beloved than the Cubs. The team is owned by the Tribune Company. Recently, Chairman Sam Zell said he'd consider renaming Wrigley Field with a corporate sponsor. Of course, this caused an uproar. The Tribune's competitor, the Sun-Times, held a contest. $1,000 for the best music video skewering Zell's plan. This was the winner. This morning, we found out who was secretly behind the winning video in the Sun-Times contest. It was a group of employees at the Tribune. So I guess Chicago's newspaper war isn't dead after all. This is the Morning Report for Friday, March 21st on Marketplace.org. The old saying about the stock market is, think of it as a barometer, not a thermometer. In other words, it's about the future, not the present. So while Wall Street might be trying to look past recession, Main Street is just starting to deal with it. For example, retail stores. Sally Herships has more.
Americans are stretching their dollars these days. Mark Karimzada of Women's Wear Daily says everyday shoppers aren't splashing out as much.
If you look at the past few months, Neiman Marcus and Saks have both reported that they feel the pinch of the recession in consumer traffic. They've seen a slowdown in their stores on the floors.
But a down market doesn't mean bad news for everyone. Analysts have high hopes for discounters like Fred's, which releases earnings next week. But off-price retailers could still suffer from tight credit and high gas prices. Retail consultant Howard Davidowitz says these stores aren't recession-proof.
I think there's lots of discounters feeling the pain right now. And by the way, that includes Target and Kmart.
Can any part of the fashion biz catch a break? Karimzada of Women's Wear says accessories makers could benefit as shoppers buy belts or handbags rather than a whole new look. I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Tomorrow, Taiwan elects a new president. One of the big issues in the campaign is whether there should be closer economic ties with mainland China. That could include direct commercial flights. Getting across the Taiwan Straits is a major hassle, but lots of business people do it anyway. Marketplace's Scott Tong has this story.
Mark Foreman runs a manufacturing and consulting firm in Taiwan. His factories are in China, so he has to fly there. The odyssey goes like this, as Foreman describes by Skype internet phone.
For me to get one working day done, I need to basically spend 3 days to do that.
4:30 in the morning, airport bus. It's 2 hours of iPod time. The bus goes north and the plane goes south to Hong Kong. Now, remember,
I want to go to China. I didn't want to come just to Hong Kong. I actually want to go into southern China.
First, the visa. Foreman schleps his bag through Hong Kong Immigration and Customs and then hops a train to the visa office.
Please stand back from the doors.
And all afternoon, he waits and wanders. As for his bags...
I've actually gone to hotels that I've stayed at previously and see if I can get some nice concierge to take pity on me and actually check my bag, put it behind the counter.
By dinner time, Mark Foreman has his visa and he boards another bus to the China border, again with the customs and the immigration. And by now, he's also changed currency twice.
Of course, anytime you exchange, you're not getting a straight-up exchange. It's like you start out with a loaf of bread and every time it's handled, there's crumbs falling off, if not chunks.
Inside China...
It's like total chaos. I mean, there's just masses of people on the other side.
Finally, bus number 3 and 90 more minutes.
I've left my house about 4:30 a.m. and it is now 8:30 p.m. of the same day that it finally got to my destination, which as the crow flies, if there was a direct flight from where I am, I would probably get there in about an hour and a half.
Or think of it this way. Had Mark Foreman left Taiwan and gone the other way, he'd be at his mom's by now, in Phoenix. In Shanghai, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Been a pretty tough stretch for the markets and the economy. I was thinking maybe we could use a chuckle. So without further ado, may I present the stand-up economist.
So you might be an economist if you think that America's next top model is a nonlinear growth model with endogenous technological change. I'm actually well-trained to be a stand-up comic because one of the hard things about stand-up comedy is learning to deal with failure. I'm actually an expert at dealing with failure because I used to teach introductory microeconomics at 8 o'clock in the morning in Walla Walla, Washington.
His name is Yoram Bauman. Yoram, tell me, how does one become a stand-up economist?
Mostly by accident. While I was in graduate school, I sort of blew off some steam by writing a parody of an economics textbook. I passed it around the department, and then it ended up getting published in this science humor journal called The Annals of Improbable Research. And they happened to do a humor session every year, so they invited me to present my paper there, which I did, and I had so much fun with it, I decided I needed to try it down at the comedy club.
And how'd that go?
Kind of a mixed bag. I quickly learned that I needed to tell some jokes that were not just about economics, but I've since learned to deal with crowds that are kind of economics crowds and crowds that are a little more drunk than that, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually got laughs on the first ever joke that I told at a comedy club was how my father was not thrilled that I was taking my PhD in economics and moving into the realm of stand-up comedy. He said, Yoram, you could never be a stand-up economist. There's no demand. And I said, don't worry, Dad, I'm a supply-side economist. I just stand up and let the jokes trickle down. I believe in the laugher curve.
I don't know, Yoram. That one might deserve a little heckling. Anyway, I know that you're an environmental economist. And obviously, climate change is a big concern right now, but it's not very funny. So how do you approach that one?
I can only give you a joke that I'm kind of working on. I can't say that it's really ready for prime time yet, but the joke is that the evidence of climate change is everywhere, that every year the snows start melting earlier and every year the flowers start to bloom earlier. And the one that economists really like is that every year the Christmas shopping season starts earlier.
That's not too bad.
Yeah, I'm working on it.
Do you find, though, that using humor does help you maybe explain things better?
Oh, absolutely. The challenge that economists have is that we've been talking about environmental taxes, environmental tax reform for 80 years, going on 100 years. It's been incredibly difficult to move it actually into practice. So I figured, why not give it a try of doing something with humor, and maybe it'll stick that way.
Yoram Bauman, the stand-up economist. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
Yoram teaches at the University of Washington in Seattle. You can find a link to his website at marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Scott Jagow. Thanks for listening, and have a great weekend.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.